Storytelling is an art form. I remember back some years ago now, attending a BBC Live studio interview with John Barrant about his then recently published novel Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil. I remember him commenting on how in the South people embroider their stories with anecdotal asides. He gave an illustration suggesting that an English writer might tell us simply, Mrs. Green, while walking down the high street in her fine fur coat, suddenly caught a glimpse of herself in the store window. How fine this coat looks, she mused. He contrasted this voice with a southern narrator. Mrs. Green, while walking down the high street in her fine fur coat, you know the coat her husband bought her after he made all that money from that shady real estate deal, you know the one he made with that big Yankee corporation buying up the whole town? Catching a glimpse of herself in the store window and remembering her husband's last year's birthday present of a facelift, how mighty fine this coat looks, she mused to herself smugly. I wish I had Jesus' knack for storytelling. His stories confront his listeners with something profound and potentially life-changing. But have you noticed how simply most of his stories begin? There was this woman or this man. We want to know which woman, what man. So he then tells us a little more. Oh yes, this woman who was coming to draw water. Or this man whose name was Zacchaeus, the one who had climbed up the tree. And so Jesus begins. Two men went up to the temple to pray. Which two men? One a Pharisee, the other a tax collector. Immediately, his first century audience would begin to draw conclusions from the stark contrast between these two men. One a righteous practitioner of the law, a faithful Jew, and the other a collaborator with the hated Roman occupation. We, that is his 21st century audience, also immediately draw conclusions, although the opposite ones from his original hearers, because we are primed to think bad thoughts when we hear that one of the men was a Pharisee. Of course, for us, it's different because we have heard the story many times, at least once every 3 years, and we know the ending. But are we any wiser as to the deeper significance of the story? The question we might ask at this point is, which of the two men do we identify with? While you're thinking about this, let me remind you, we're hearing this story within the context of the annual renewal campaign, commonly known as stewardship. We tend to think of stewardship as an activity for this time of year, and unfortunately not as a whole year-round activity, a year-round exercise of the three T's, time, talent, and treasure, as the practice of gentle competence in the service of all things. There is a natural tendency to overvalue the treasure component of the three T's. In Small Hearts, Enlarged by Gratitude, on October the 8th, I spoke about how treasure is really a symbol for the way we express gratitude through living generously. In Time, Talent, and Not Just Treasure, last week on October the 16th, I fleshed out time and talent as symbols of both our desire to serve and also our realization that as disciples we have little choice but to keep serving. For a disciple who does not serve is an oxymoron, a linking of two incongruous images in one idea. Given that Christian community is the historic template for serving community, I think that if asked to pause and reflect more deeply, the thing many of us would say is that we miss the satisfaction of service inspired by gratitude. Gratitude produces and stimulates generosity. And generosity, like living water, flows through service, irrigating a parched land. Remember that money is like water. It only does any good if it keeps flowing. Dam it up, and stagnation ensues. So back to the question. Which of the two men do we identify with? It would be interesting to call for a show of hands, but I suspect that most of us would identify with the tax collector because in the story, we are prejudiced towards the Pharisee from the outset and distanced from the socio-political contradiction of a tax collector praying in the temple. Conditioned by 2,000 years of Christian teaching on the virtue of humility, we see in the tax collector's prayer a level of humility and self-abasement we wish we could emulate. Few of us, publicly at least, would want to identify with the haughty self-righteousness of the religious Pharisee. This is a story that presents us with two images of the human response to God. Most of us intuit that we should identify with the tax collector, and yet we design our lives to model that of the Pharisee and feel pretty good about doing so. He's not only confident in his own salvation, but loudly proclaims his self-confidence before the Lord of heaven and earth. In other words, this is a man who, by following the rules, takes control of his salvation. Look, God, and see how well I'm doing. The tax collector, on the other hand, makes no claim to being in control of his life, let alone has any expectation of salvation. He lives a morally dubious and compromised life. He may be deeply sorry about his collaboration with the Roman administration, but the sorry fact is that what else can he do? Like many, he's caught in the traps that life sets. He needs to work. He needs to do what he needs to do and get by. So he's caught. Jesus makes clear that for God, it's not what the tax collector does. It's not his occupation that matters. It's not even a matter of his being among the religiously impure, those on the outside of Jewish religious life. What matters is his response, his humble recognition that he has no claim on God's mercy. He offers no excuses. He offers no defense. The very nature of his inability to do much about his situation is what brings him to his knees, beating his breast in acknowledgement that he stands before the Lord of heaven and earth as one in need of God's mercy. Like the Pharisee, we expend a lot of energy ensuring that we will not find ourselves in a position of needing anything from anyone. So self-assured are we of our ability to make our own way in life, we easily confuse our success for something of our own making, that the good things in life are ours to enjoy and not share. The Pharisee, that part of us that sneakily believes that we have no need of God, is very much alive and kicking in all of us. Yet the unpalatable truth in the face of our assertions of self-sufficiency is that the source of all our loves in life flow to us from God's love for us. Whether we want to admit it or not, we are in fact dependent beneficiaries of divine generosity. And only when we acknowledge our dependence can we come to know our need of God. To acknowledge our need of God is an uncomfortable experience for us. We're surrounded by good people who do what good people do, but who seem to have no need of God. The conventional wisdom goes that if God exists at all, then of course he will be accepting of those who, after all, are good people. However, that is not the conclusion we can legitimately draw from this story. For only one man goes home justified. To understand the way Jesus uses the term justified, we need to think about what happens in a court of law. Neither the plaintiff nor the defendant is in control of the verdict of the court. It's only the judge who can acquit or condemn. So it is with being justified. The Pharisee's religious virtues in no way justify him in God's eyes. Neither does the tax collector's sinfulness condemn him. Justification turns on a single question. Which one is in need of God? Jesus tells us this is the only consideration for God. Being justified or not is a divine verdict, not anything we can earn as if by right or lose because of compromised circumstances in life. Now, I'm not sure that we can rid ourselves of conflating stewardship with the autumn renewal campaign. But it's a worthy goal to reach for. Therefore, I'm encouraging us to use this season of the annual renewal campaign as an invitation to take spiritual inventory, in which we review what and where are our priorities and how are these shaped by our faith and our experience of Christian community. What is our attitude to our finances and possessions? Are these simply the fruit of the sweat of our own clever brow? Or can we find in them a freedom? Yes, a freedom from self-congratulation that comes with gratitude expressed through generosity. In the spiritual inventory, can we review this as an opportunity to re-examine our attitude towards the call of discipleship? With whom do we really align? The Pharisee or the tax collector? The problem is, it's a bit of both. And finally, in the spiritual inventory, can we rediscover the single thing that ultimately matters? Namely, our coming to know again the depth of our need for God. 2 weeks ago in Small Hearts Enlarged by Gratitude, I shared from my personal experience of gratitude. And mine is a story of the way connection with gratitude wanes in the face of the illusion of my self-sufficiency. This period of spiritual inventory is an opportunity for me to see again the unseen hand of God's loving presence in my life and to stand with the tax collector, openly acknowledging that there is nothing about me that is deserving of God's love, and to remember with gratitude expressed in generous living that all the good things of my life come to me as an expression of divine gift.